Henry II of England and his wife, Eleanor of Aquitaine, have created and ruled the Plantagenet Empire, the most dynamic, wealthiest, and most powerful kingdom in Western Europe. But the Plantagenets are rarely at peace, and Henry's temper and ego has long troubled his family and his people, from the shocking martyrdom of Thomas Becket to the vicious Great Rebellion that saw Eleanor sent to prison for 15 years. Meanwhile, their brilliant, avaricious, rebellious children have grown, fought, ruled, married, and even died, so that of his five sons, only two survive, Richard Lionheart and John Lackland. Now, as the 12th century enters its final decade, Henry himself dies, leaving his great legacy poised at the edge of great success or great failure. Here's the story of what happens as Richard and John take their turns on the Plantagenet throne.
Welcome back to Season 3 of Lion's Forge. My name is Becket, and I want to tell you a story. An epic, true story of five kings and the Lion Queen. Season 3, Episode 6, A Bad Storm Coming. That cruel winter of 1190, the situation at Acre was indeed a perfect stalemate. Saladin stayed behind with a small force, sending the bulk of his army off to shelter and rest during the cold, dark desert winter. It was a respite that came just in time. If the Europeans were demoralized by their bad luck and hard lives, the Saracens were no better off. Acre had worn men on both sides to the most basic grit of themselves. The people they were when they started had not eaten a decent meal, slept in a decent bed, been away from the sounds of screaming horses and thudding arrows, washed in something besides a cup of water, or smelled air free of rotting corpses for a year. Both sides had seen brothers, friends, wives, and babies die. Both had begun to forget that you could spend a day free of a hacking cough, a wound going a worrisome green, simple exhaustion deepened and broadened by starvation. And there was no end to it. Neither side could expect supplies by land or by sea. Neither could expect reinforcements until the desert spring would come months off into the future. Now, the Crusaders would have the worst of it, given their lack of good shelter. Winter rains poured down into soaked, fraying tents, dousing the open fires that were the one source of warmth and companionship. Skin diseases were rampant, since no one could get dry. By Christmas, entirely out of food, things already terribly bad got worse. Civilized people from great cities in Europe grazed like cattle for thin winter grasses. Lack of vitamins produced scurvy, where you'd wake up to find your teeth scattered across your bedding and brackish blood pooled under your nails. Dreadful sanitation accompanied by starvation eventually produced plague. Such intense deprivation would leave even strong men little more than dwindled, half-dead ghosts of their former selves. Cannibalism probably occurred that hideous winter, given letters written by crusaders that refer to men eating abominable food, things which should not be spoken of, things humans are not permitted to eat. There was the medieval version of a hospital at Acre, named after Thomas Becket, a place to rest and receive some nursing care, usually from family. Hospitals of the day provided very little by way of actual medical treatment. One can visualize doctors shaking their heads as they smelled gangrene, trying to cauterize already wrecked bodies with iron probes so hot they could boil water. Hundreds died every day. So much death brought more hard labor for anyone still able to turn a shovel. People committed suicide, went mad. Some gave up so totally that they renounced Christ and turned themselves over to the Muslims. And so it went on, unimaginable day after unimaginable day, until the first supply ship of the new year crested the ocean horizon at the beginning of March 1191. Incredible as it must have seemed to them, the Europeans realized they weren't all dead, all decayed, all insane. Enough of them had somehow made it through that second winter in front of the besieged city to be able to stretch aching bodies, turn sword blades against grinding stones, brush filth from ragged clothing. They still had an army. And if they had been weakened by the winter they had barely survived, their counterparts behind the walls of Acre had their own agonized stories. Like the Crusaders, the city's defenders were starved, sick, exhausted, almost broken. A sea caravan of 7 transports that promised food, weapons, reinforcements, blankets, and hope had gone down in a New Year's storm. Then, to add to Acre's misery, incessant rain undercut a section of the city's wall, which collapsed. The Crusaders were too worn to take advantage of the unexpected invitation, and repairs were hurriedly made. But everyone trapped in Acre realized that the city could not hold out much longer without help. And help was not exactly pouring across Acre's plains. Saladin wrote a disgusted letter describing reinforcements whose first question upon reaching his lines was how soon they could go home. But this grim deadlock was about to break. Although they had taken an eternity to arrive, the majority of the Crusader army, some 19,000 men led by Richard Lionheart and Philip Augustus, would soon be landing on the sand-swept coastline. While the exact number of European Third Crusaders has never been firmly settled, most historians seem comfortable with a count of about 20,000 from Western Europe, dominated by Plantagenet forces. Roughly another 35,000 Germans set out from their lands. As we know, most of the Germans didn't make it. The effort involved in moving 20,000 men and their animals, siege equipment, armor, saddles, tents, maps, blacksmith tools, medicine chests, arrows, lances, harnesses, and trade goods entirely by sweated labor fascinates the 21st century mind. Routes had to be reasoned out, approvals obtained to pass through foreign countries, adequate markets identified, masses of shipping placed where it would be needed. We still have merchant invoices submitted to the King of England for staggering quantities of goods. 60,000 iron horseshoes, 14,000 salted pig carcasses, tons of cheeses, beans, and crossbow bolts, all of which had to be produced, adequately packed, and then transported across half the known world by hand. Both Richard and Philip firmly intended to avoid the march across Byzantium that had marred the start of the Second Crusade. Despite the staggering expense, which Richard had raided the Plantagenet world to afford, these crusaders would rely on ships and the sea far more than their predecessors had. This did not exactly promise luxury. Vessels of the day, packed with men and animals, stank and wallowed, prey to storms, prey to becalmed winds. War horses that could normally endure virtually anything needed several weeks of rest on dry land before they could go back to work. But despite its drawbacks, sea travel was faster, as well as possessing the incontestable benefit of keeping pauper pilgrims back at the dock. These crusaders had also learned another lesson, this one about discipline, that Achilles' heel of the Second Crusade. Richard's penalties for bad behavior smacked of Zengi Adin's tough regime back in his day. If you murdered someone, you could look forward to being tied to the corpse and either thrown overboard if at sea, or buried alive if on land. simply pulling a knife in the heat of the moment would see the offending hand sliced off. Little wonder the chroniclers rarely mention crime amid the ranks, despite the presence of soldiers like the men from the London neighborhood of St. Clair's and Usk, described by contemporaries as downright villains and notorious criminals. And genuine pride also played a role. Well-equipped, tax-supported, disciplined to a fare thee well, and led by the battle-toughened King Richard Lionheart, the Plantagenet Empire sent thousands of its men off to recapture Holy Jerusalem. Richard's army initially joined the French under his friend Philip Augustus at Vezelay in July 1190, the town made famous at the start of the Second Crusade, when Bernard of Clairvaux preached his mesmerizing sermon to 100,000 avid volunteers. This time, well-equipped and well-trained though they were, the English reaching Magdalene Shrine were laboring under a gloomy sense of misfortune to come. Perhaps a consequence of all those years living under battle conditions, with poor food, poor sanitation, and poor shelter, Richard had already aged more than would seem warranted given his 30-odd years. He suffered from boils, possibly from anemia, and from what was then called quartan fever, a form of malaria. Daily life for Richard would have been a constant trial, at least in small, painful, annoying ways. Men worried that the harsh climate of Syria could finish him off. To round out everyone's fears, he had been given his crusader's staff a couple of weeks earlier at the grand send-off in Tours. Rotted in some imperceptible way, it fell apart before he'd walked 10 feet, convincing witnesses that things would not be going all that well in the Holy Land. It actually wasn't an idle omen. No one at Vezelay had word yet, but the German crusader army, which had gone ahead, had lost its leader a month before. The 70-year-old Holy Roman Emperor, Frederick Barbarossa, was dead, drowned in a Turkish river. His son took command, but Frederick of Swabia, no matter how confident and well-intentioned, was no Frederick Barbarossa. The disaster left the German army muted and somber. By the time it got to Acre, it would be worn down to a fraction of its initial size. Richard and Philip, not knowing about this awful misfortune, shook hands on a poorly defined pact that whatever booty might come their way would be shared. It was just vague enough to be agreeable to both, while virtually ensuring that they'd eventually fight over it. They did agree to peace in Europe while both were on crusade, and they established their plan of march, which divided the two armies to increase their odds of finding food among the locals as they passed. Their mutual destination was the port of Messina in Sicily, that rugged volcanic arrowhead of an island just across from the toe of the Italian boot. It took the French a mere 6 weeks to make their way from Vezelay, in the middle of their country, to Genoa in northern Italy, and then by ship to Sicily. Richard and his army took a different route, marching south toward Marseille, where his fleet was expected. He sailed into Messina a week after Philip. It was already late September. Winter would soon be coming on in all its drenching, freezing misery. And its churning seas held no appeal for sailors of the era, who clung to coastlines even in good weather. The King of France was accordingly anxious to get on with things, apparently planning on heading out the day Richard arrived, only to be stopped by a storm. Richard, however, would be moving at a different pace. One reason was an insult visited upon Richard's sister Joan, who happened to be the Sicilian queen. The other was money, specifically Sicilian gold. The ultimate outcome would be a permanent split between those dear friends Richard Lionheart and Philip Augustus. As might be remembered from the story of the Second Crusade, the Normans had made themselves the dominant power in Sicily. Essentially a very large triangular mountain floating in the Mediterranean, Sicily sat squarely amid the greatest sea routes in the medieval world and had made itself a fortune growing and trading wheat, oranges, lemons, sugar, pistachios, and cotton. The island in our day is scarcely famous for its wealth, but Sicilian kings of the Crusader era reigned over a fabulously rich country that reached up into Italy. Their outsized ambition stretched as far as Greece, Constantinople, and Anatolia. Sicily's kings were so well off, they could afford the flamboyant gesture of setting solid gold and silver tiles into the floors of their palace at Palermo, not to mention building an artificial lake out back big enough to float a ship. Their country was welcoming to a cosmopolitan society of Arab scholars, Genoan traders, French knights on their way to a tour of duty in the Outremer, monks from Normandy, and sailors from Lisbon who mingled, talked, cooked, slept with the native girls, learned each other's languages, and read each other's books. The island's most recent king, yet another king named William, had been long married to none other than Joan Plantagenet, seventh of the Plantagenet offspring. King William, sufficiently even-tempered to earn the nickname The Good during his lifetime, despite his well-stocked harem, and to be granted a place in paradise by Dante, had died the year before the Crusaders arrived on his shores. During his lifetime, he had filled treasure chest after treasure chest to fund a crusade, one he never had the time to make. Unfortunately for the ultimate peace of his Plantagenet in-laws, he had also failed to beget an heir. To further complicate Sicilian political life circa 1190, the Germans brooded over Sicily like a bad storm coming. One of Frederick Barbarossa's sons had been long married to a Sicilian princess. When King William died childless, this lady became the most direct heir to the Sicilian throne, and the Germans naturally assumed that the riches of the Kingdom of Sicily would soon be pouring into their coffers. Instead, a local civil war flared over the supposedly assured succession. The winning side was a shock to the Germans, since it rejected German overlordship, choosing instead a bastard cousin of William's, operatically named Tancred. The Germans accordingly had no love for the current Sicilian government, and would not be pleased if anyone else expressed affection for it. Illegitimate by birth and by his conflicted ascension to the throne, Tancred had a shakier than normal hold on his kingdom, where Sicilian natives jostled for dominance with Normans, Germans, Christians, and Muslims. The new king thus had an array of troubles to plague him even before shiploads of bored, aggressive, hungry crusaders came ashore. He had also made a very thoughtless mistake at a time when Richard Lionheart was already heading his way. He had placed the widow Joan Plantagenet under guard and taken control of her considerable dowry. In addition, he'd seized all the lovely gold saved up by his predecessor to fund a crusade, even though it was widely believed that King William had bequeathed the treasure to his father-in-law, Henry Plantagenet. Henry was dead. Richard, upon arrival, was typically direct. According to his thinking, he was both his father's heir and a king leading a crusade. The money, therefore, obviously belonged to him. And while everyone was taking care of that, he wanted his widowed sister and her dowry, consisting of the queen's chair, the gilded 12-foot table, the golden plates and silver goblets brought back as well. There are more stories about Lionheart's other demands, demands that the Sicilians fulfill promises supposedly made by William, promises of things like a silk tent that could seat 200 at mealtime, 100 of the great warships called dromons, and enough wheat, barley, and wine to make a very nice addition to Crusader provisions. Richard wanted every bit of it. This was disputed back and forth for a couple of weeks between the Sicilians and their continental guests, a dispute fueled by shortages in the local markets, rocketing food prices, and crusaders behaving badly toward the locals. After a couple of desultory negotiations, Richard resolved the problem as Richard often did, by calling up his army and seizing the best object at hand, which in this case was the capital city, Messina. Given that Messina had been seized by one or another power for the past 1,000 years, one might wonder if its citizens were fundamentally resigned to the idea. This time, the crusaders fought Tancred's men up and down Messina's hilly streets, as locals ducked inside their front doors and cowered in the back room with the baby and the goats. The aftermath of this short-lived, if bloody, contest was another win for Lionheart, who then let his men go on to disperse arson, rape, and theft throughout the unhappy populace. Richard, who rarely seems to have a sense of humor, gave in to some private whim and had a mobile wooden fort built above the city, which he christened Metgriffon, loosely translated as kill all the locals. His old friend and ally, Philip Augustus, was no happier with Plantagenet aggression in Sicily than the inhabitants of Messina. The French sat out the fight. French reluctance to engage wasn't an expression of newfound crusader pacifism, but rather a sign of growing hostility between the two European monarchs, former friends though they might be. Even kings aren't safe from jealousy, and Philip had much to resent when it came to older, taller, stronger, more famous, more feared, more admired, and far wealthier Richard. There was the touchy matter of Alice, still unmarried. There was the dynastic shoving for dominance in Anjou, Toulouse, the Aquitaine, and Normandy. And always, over everything, there was Eleanor of Aquitaine, whose priceless gift to Henry Plantagenet had shoved Louis Capet and his son into the Plantagenet shade. The Capets wanted their place in the sun back, and Philip had intended to get it since he'd been a boy. The French king hadn't spent much time with Richard in the past few years. Now that they were again rubbing shoulders, things were not going well. Philip asked for various boons from his more powerful rival, like a loan of ships. Richard took his time before answering, tantamount to leaving Philip fuming in an anteroom, and his response often fell short of the original request. Real and imagined slights at Richard's hands piled up. Philip became increasingly testy, and took to making rancid observations about Lionheart's character, which the French freely shared with the impressionable and beleaguered young Tancred. Before long, Philip probably stooped to whispering warnings that Richard wasn't above deposing the anxious young king. Still, try as he might, it was a losing game for Philip. Lionheart was at a vast advantage when it came to gaining allies, given the size of his purse and army. Richard signed a protective treaty with Tancred, including a provision betrothing his nephew, Little Arthur of Brittany, to Tancred's daughter. This blandly ignored the fact that Philip Augustus had already promised his own daughter as Arthur's bride-to-be. Richard further announced that Arthur, not yet 5 years old, a little boy from that wild Plantagenet outpost on the Atlantic, was to be considered the Plantagenet heir, thus snatching the boy back from Philip's protection. After that, Richard and Philip, about to go fight the Saracens together, were no longer eating at the same table and sleeping in the same bed, even though they spent the next 6 months waiting for spring while tethered to the island. From here on, their relationship would do little but deteriorate for the rest of their lives. Lionheart's generosity toward Tancred and Arthur may have made Philip gnash his teeth, but it had far more serious unintended consequences. For one thing, it placed Richard at profound odds with the Holy Roman Empire, which had major claims and ambitions of its own in this part of the world. Richard accordingly acquired a new, unnecessary, and quite powerful enemy on the continent. one which would eventually cause him and his kingdom no end of trouble. His Sicilian promises would also cause him significant trouble at home, where John Lackland was about to find out he had been passed over as heir to the Plantagenet Empire. Grown men in a dozen European courts were furiously calculating how to take advantage of this promising situation in the quite likely event Arthur's uncle and John's brother didn't come back from Jerusalem. Among those calculating were both John Lackland, the passed over brother, and Philip Augustus, the rival king. Richard's untroubled sense of his own power made him discount both of them. It would turn out to be a fairly bad mistake. We've come to the end of our story for the time being. I am Beckett Arnold, narrating from the book Lion's Forge, adapted for us by the author Karen Markle Knapp. Thank you to Francis Butt for voicing our introduction and so much more. If you like what you hear, please give us a rating, follow our channel, and share us with your friends. Most importantly, please join us again December 2nd for the next episode of Lion's Forge, available everywhere you get your favorite podcasts, including on YouTube with video episode trailers. Visit us on Facebook, where you can ask questions, leave reviews, and interact with me. Until next time, thank you for listening.